Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Early in 2023, a group of scientists led by BYU's Ben Abbott issued a report saying that emergency measures were needed to rescue the Great Salt Lake from collapse. Last month, climate scientist and journalist Matthew LaPlante, in several articles in the Salt Lake Tribune and on his science podcast Undisciplined, which you hear on UPR, claimed that the 2023 report missed several key factors and should not have emphasized the most dire potential outcome for the lake. So, we're going to ask in this hour, what is the most likely future of the Great Salt Lake, and what should we do about it? And we're joined by Ben Abbott, who is BYU Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So, just a note here, I didn't invite Matthew LaPlante on this program because I'm assuming that our listeners will have heard his three-part series on his podcast, which is broadcast on UPR. And will likely have read the Salt Lake Tribune articles. So I'm taking that as a given, and bringing you on, Ben Abbott, to give some rebuttal, but also to give your perspective on the future of the lake. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. And you know, it's interesting. The scientific process is a conversation, right, between different teams of researchers who are looking at different types of data and interpreting it independently. So I think it's really valuable to have that process unveiled a little bit. On the other hand, it's really difficult. The media is trying to convey some of those important messages from science to the public, and it can sometimes be hard to distinguish between one study that, of course, has any single study has strengths and weaknesses from the scientific consensus on this issue. And so if I were to just boil it down to what I think the most important message is for people to take away is, you know, our water consumption is driving the decline of Great Salt Lake. It accounts for about two-thirds to maybe 80% of the decline of Great Salt Lake is from that water consumption. Then that remaining third to 20% is coming from weather variability, the drought that we've been in, as well as human-caused climate change. But in Matthew's reporting, he really emphasizes the long-term climate trend, which will become more important as we move into the future. But right now, I think we really need to keep our eye on the ball. This is an issue caused by overuse of water locally within the Great Salt Lake watershed.
So Matthew, in his report, he says that your report's outcome, that you predicted the dire outcome, the 5-year drying up, could have happened, but it wasn't at that point the most likely outcome. He says you overemphasized that. What do you say?
Yeah, you know, we as we were putting that report together in late 2022, it's really interesting. We discussed for multiple weeks, you know, what the right language would be. Here's the situation as we saw it then, and actually as it still remains today. Great Salt Lake in 2022 wasn't 5 years away from collapse. It was potentially 5 months away from collapse. You know, the salinity in the lake was so high that all it would have taken was even if we'd had an average precipitation winter, the lake still would have crossed that salinity threshold. The brine shrimp, the brine flies wouldn't have been able to reproduce. Dust hotspots around the lake, mineral extraction would have stopped. So we were really up against the wall. And the conversation that we had wasn't about whether we should point out this scenario that, you know, if we continue losing water at the rate that we had been over the last 3 years, the lake could disappear as we know it within 5 years. That was pretty clear. We were going to at least point that out. The more controversial discussion was, do we need to ring that alarm bell and say, you know, we're within a year of ecological death of Great Salt Lake, right? That was the question. Ultimately, we pointed out both of those facts, how close we are to the edge. We described it as the ongoing collapse of Great Salt Lake. But I absolutely feel that we were justified in being very clear. And in fact, I wouldn't have felt ethical as a researcher not disclosing that, you know, because the dialogue was so different even at that time as the lake reached an all-time low. There was talk about, you know, over the next 30 years, we need to reduce water consumption, or this could get really bad. When, as we talked with biologists, ecologists, water managers, hydrologists, and some state officials, it was really clear that we were facing an extremely bad outcome within months, not years. Mm.
I want to talk about the, I guess, the politics of this. I'm quoting Matthew LaPlante here in his podcast. Hopefully I got this correct. He says, all involved, meaning you and your colleagues, were possibly biased by your love of the lake. And he says specifically you, Ben Abbott, admitted, he, according to Matthew, that he's an advocate for the lake to the legislature. So I don't think you would deny that, an advocate. But you're also a scientist, right? You want to get the science right. That's a kind of a tricky, line to toe. Especially you do want action. You do believe to your core that action is needed. But I wondered, kind of, now looking forward, the governor having called your report a joke, right? And possibly, I don't know what his intentions are, gearing up to do less on the lake because of that. I wonder how you navigate all that.
Yeah, well, to the first point, I absolutely am an advocate for Great Salt Lake. I'm a lifelong Utahan. I grew up in Orem. Love recreating in Utah Lake and Great Salt Lake. But beyond that, I mean, I feel a personal responsibility, a moral responsibility, and for me, as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a religious responsibility and duty to care for God's creation. So guilty as charged. I absolutely am an advocate. And I think that there is a really counterproductive idea that many people have, including some scientists, that as scientists, we're only allowed to describe information, that we deliver data that is produced objectively, and then we hand it over to the public or policymakers, and then it's completely their job to interpret and implement that. I think that's a really, really poor way to manage a watershed, or especially as we're looking at more broadly with the Anthropocene, the Earth system as a whole. Humans have become the most important factor regulating the Earth's climate, biogeochemical cycles, creation and destruction of species, thinking about biodiversity. And so we've got to be really, really effective at generating information and then changing our behavior to ensure a sustainable future. And I think it's actually helpful to think about medical doctors. Now, imagine if you went in for a wellness checkup and your medical doctor simply gave you a sheet that listed off your body mass index and cholesterol and other markers, right, of health. And then they said, okay, my job's done. I'm not going to prescribe any action, right? I'm going to be objective and I don't want to overstep and advocate for anything, right? You just take that information and decide what you're going to do. I think that we'd want our money back from that doctor. Right. So likewise here, I'm not an elected official. I don't have any control over what the government does. But I certainly, as in thinking more broadly to this team that put the report together, we had researchers, legal experts, advocates and nonprofit groups that participated. And that was on purpose so that we could do more than simply show a line tracing the decline of Great Salt Lake. We wanted to be able to make practical and constructive recommendations. So to the second part of the question, what has the governmental response been and what was the impact of the report on our readiness to save Great Salt Lake? There's a lot of intellectual humility here. I don't know. I've tried to run that counterfactual in my mind a lot of times. If we hadn't been so clear in that report, what would the impact have been if we had hedged more and put more caveats on that scenario that the lake, as we know it, could disappear in 5 years? Would we be in a better place today? I don't know, right? What I do stand behind completely is we put forward our best interpretation of what was going on with the lake and how we could get out of that situation at that time. And there was a big shift in, let's take the governor as an example. We sent this report to the governor's office and to the legislature before we released it publicly, right? We wanted to make sure nobody was taken by surprise. And if you read the report, you can still find it, gsl.byu.edu, GSL for Great Salt Lake. We really wanted to recognize the important work that had been done, right? We've got a whole table showing what the legislature had been doing. So this wasn't some kind of adversarial thing where we were saying our state leaders are delinquent and they're not trying. We were trying to help. And we got a call from the governor's office the next day where they said, you know, we read your report, and the term, you know, the phrase they used was, you know, it's scared the pants off of us, and we're going to make sure that this doesn't happen. You know, because that scenario wasn't a prediction of what would happen. It was one of many possible futures, right? If we didn't take action, if water flows didn't increase, then that was the worst case scenario. And so it was a really encouraging response from the governor's office. And in fact, the phrase was, you know, we're going to call for fast and prayer for this, but faith isn't enough. We also need works, right? That's our brand. And so we're also going to engage in unprecedented action to release water from reservoirs, to pay farmers to not grow crops temporarily, to stabilize the lake. And so that was initially really encouraging. And then over the last year, there's definitely been a shift in that rhetoric that is above my pay grade, right? Is that because it was an election year? Is that because of broader political trends? I don't know. But I pay more attention to what people do than what they say. So we are really advocating for, we're supporting the governor's request in his budget for more money to go to the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's Office. I think that's one of the most impactful things that could happen this legislative session, right? We need to be investing in the people, the infrastructure, the data that we need to save Great Salt Lake.
One more thing in this general area, and then we'll get into some more specifics and definitely look to the future of the lake. So ask about the politics of this. I want to ask about an adjacent topic, which is the psychology, right? Psychology, yeah. Getting people to act, right? So I remember the governor, Cox, said, I think this was in 2023, he said, doom doesn't produce change. He said that doom just kind of gets us depressed and doesn't get change. To the extent that we were at doom, and I'm not saying your report just, you know, specifically went there, I would argue that, boy, it did produce change. Whatever it was, there was action. There was a lot of action.
Yeah. this is such a difficult topic, right? If you think about air pollution research, you know, we realized in the mid 20th century how toxic air pollution was for human health, not just for lungs, but actually the number one negative impact of air pollution is cardiovascular disease, heart attacks, strokes, as well as reproductive dysfunction. I mean, every system in the human body is negatively impacted by air pollution at every stage of human development, prenatal and all the way up to end of life. So the researchers that were sharing that research, I don't think that they were sowing or selling doom. I think that they were exposing truth, right? And it is true that there are dangerous things in the world. It's true that our actions matter, and it empowers us when we have access to that truth. And there are about 120 of these saline lakes around the world, these large saline lakes. Nearly everyone is in decline. And there is not a single example of a lake, once it's shifted into decline, that has been restored. That's not doom, that is truth. And so when I think about the Aral Sea, Lake Urmia, Lake Popo, Lake Chad, Lop Nur, when I think of these lakes, each one so far has been a catastrophe. It's been a tragedy, right? We know what was causing the decline of the lake, but the right actions weren't taken to reverse that. And looking at that statistic, you know, that we have a batting average of zero, for me, it is not doomed to say, this is likely much harder than we think to save, to do, right? And that's very common. We underestimate. I teach here at BYU, right? And I remember when I was a college student, and I would always underestimate how much work it was going to be to finish my term paper, and I would overestimate my ability to do that in the 3 hours before it was due, right? I would put it off, go play frisbee, right? This is totally natural in human psychology to underestimate these long-term risks and to overestimate our capacity to solve them. And so I'm going to keep on saying, right, until we are well along the way to rescuing Great Salt Lake, that we need to do more. We need to do it faster. We need to get more people on board. But I'm not a marketing specialist. But it is interesting. I had a conversation a few weeks ago with one of our advisory board members for this group, Grow the Flow, that we've put together. His name's Mark Burnett. He's a TV producer, very prominent. And he was very clear. He said, you know, from a marketing perspective, you guys have buried the lead. And you haven't been clear enough with what the risks are. You need to be telling people, this could trash your property values. This could make your kids sick. This could increase food prices. This could disrupt global supply chains, right? The brine shrimp from Great Salt Lake support the production of 200 million tons of seafood every year, right? Great Salt Lake is feeding the world. The mineral extraction from Great Salt Lake produces around $1 billion of profit every year, right? These are really high stakes. The insurance companies in Chicago are already talking about redlining areas along the Wasatch Front, that it's not doesn't make sense for them to insure because of the decline of Great Salt Lake. So the stakes are high, and I agree with you. Understanding risk absolutely empowers us to make change. And I'm not going to mitigate my message or try to psychoanalyze the public. I think that that is paternalistic, and I think it's counterproductive, to be honest. I am going to provide my assessment. Here are what the numbers are for your health. Here is what I think you could do to fix that. And then I'm going to participate constructively in the community to try to implement those changes.
One more thing on this. I keep saying that this is the last one on this particular topic. I don't know if there's much you can do about this as an expert, as a scientist, but I'm sure you've probably noticed as well. There is a percentage of the population these days that seems to be growing, in my estimation, an anti-expert sentiment, anti-science, yeah. Right? Those pointy-headed guys who are, you know, yeah. Crying doom and gloom, and I don't believe them, and I'm gonna believe whatever I read or see. I'm gonna choose my media, and I'm not gonna listen to these guys. You know, speaking of one of those experts, I don't know how do you talk to those folks. How do you get through?
You know, people definitely are suffering, and they are skeptical. They're asking questions about where can I go to find truth, right? Who can I trust? And in that report in 2023, we identified this as the biggest challenge. Right, there actually is plenty of water in the watershed. We don't live in a desert, despite what you hear. We're in a semi-arid ecosystem. And there is enough water to go around if we were to use it wisely. What we really are, what's limiting our response is trust. And so I think when you've got an aunt or an uncle or a friend or a colleague who's in that place feeling, you know, ignored, feeling talked down to, the last thing that you want to do is pile on criticism. And so I think we really need to meet people where they are. And we've had an amazing experience with Grow the Flow. We've been holding these agricultural listening sessions where we invite farmers, conservancy district leaders to come together and to share their concerns, share their perspective. And it has been amazing to see over the course of an hour or 2 hours, if you start out with listening, if you start out with trying to understand the other person's position, their openness to new information increases exponentially versus if you show up and say, here's what you got to do, here's the only way forward. And so I think people want to be heard. I think that they want to know that experts are a part of the community too. Right? It's not a separate species or class of people. We live here. We depend on Great Salt Lake just like everybody else. And so let's work together.
So I have to ask this: do you think, you know, I take Matthew LaPlante, you know, he's sincere. He did have some specific criticisms of your report, and you know, science is a debate, right?
Yeah,
back and forth. Here's what I think the data says, and here's what I think the data says. I don't know. What do you, in the context of what we've just been saying, right? We're trying to protect the credibility of experts in a world where there's an increasing segment of people who don't trust experts. Do you think Matthew's criticisms were a disservice?
Oh, it's hard to say, right? And there are two things that went on. Matthew published a peer-reviewed paper on the interactions between groundwater and Great Salt Lake. I think that it was an interesting paper, and there's some new interpretation, new analysis there that's absolutely valuable and valid. What the second part of it was, he then, through the Undisciplined podcast, presented this research and basically said, this research overturns the consensus, and Great Salt Lake's functioning in a completely different way than we thought. And I think that that is really an exaggeration of what they found. And in fact, I think in many ways, Matthew's description on Undisciplined doesn't even represent what is in his paper as far as, okay, it looks like, absent of human diversions, there still is going to be an impact from climate change in the future. That's absolutely valid, but it's hard to keep distance with your own study, especially when you're early on as a scientist, right? You've spent a lot of time looking at this, and you know your work better than you know other people's work, and so there can easily be some bias there. So I think he overstates the importance of climate change there, even based on his own analysis, and then there are questions. In the Undisciplined podcast, he didn't disclose that he was basing the podcast series on his own research, right? And that's really important. You totally can report on your own research, but that needs to be disclosed because, again, it's different if you're saying, here are two competing scientific views versus here's my scientific view versus a consensus that's based on literally hundreds of other papers that have found that human water consumption is the primary cause of the decline of Great Salt Lake. And to put it in context, the most recent estimates that come from Utah State show that Great Salt Lake is about 15 feet lower than it would have been in 2025 because of human water consumption, right? That's cumulatively over the past many decades. So that's a huge difference, 15 feet. If we look at the climate change signal, the lake is less than 1 foot lower than it would have been otherwise, because of increased evaporation and increased temperatures. So that climate change signal is still there, but it is much, much smaller than the proximal cause of the decline of Great Salt Lake, which is direct human water use.
I believe, according to my list, and I think Matthew did put a disclosure at the very end of the episodes. I think he should have put it also at the beginning as well. But anyway, just that small point. Well, let's take a break, come back much more on this discussion, and I definitely want to get into, what your view of the future of the lake is. We just had a report out from the Great Salt Lake Strike Team. I think your team's going to have another report coming out soon, so definitely want to get into talking about that. We're talking with Ben Abbott, who is BYU Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability. He's joining us today to talk about the future of the Great Salt Lake. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour today is Ben Abbott. He's BYU Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability. He was lead of a group of scientists who issued a report in early 2023. And last month, climate scientist and journalist Matthew LaPlante took issue with some parts of that report in several articles in the Tribune and on his science podcast, Undisciplined, which you can hear on Utah Public Radio. One more thing on Matthew LaPlante, then we'll look to the future. What do you think about his points in the paper he was involved with on groundwater? He says that your report and other scientists should take this into account more. That among the reservoir, if I could make that semi-pun, of potential water going to the lake, we need to consider groundwater.
Yeah. In our report, we point out specifically that estimates of groundwater at that time were very, very coarse, right? We didn't have a good idea of how much groundwater was being contributed to the lake. But that doesn't invalidate at all the trend that lake level was going through. So, for example, if Matthew's right and groundwater is going to stabilize the lake and prevent it from having these big dips, then we wouldn't have seen the extreme drop from 2020 to 2023 that we did in Great Salt Lake. And that was one of the things that we pointed out in the report. The lake is dropping faster than our models suggested that it would. And we do think that that is partly because of a reversal of groundwater flow to the lake. So I think of it a little bit like a bank account. You know, Great Salt Lake is our bank account of water. We've got different ways of depositing water into the lake. The most important is river runoff. The second most important, which is a surprise, is direct rain and snow that falls into Great Salt Lake. It's so large that between a quarter to a third of the water that enters the lake actually is falling directly onto the lake itself. And then the third most important is groundwater. So our estimates of all three of those are imperfect. They're getting better through time. And Matthew's work, I think, contributes to that improvement. But the lake, ultimately, the lake level is our KPR, our KPI, our key performance indicator that matters most. And if it's going down, we don't need to know exactly, okay, is that a decrease in runoff, precipitation, or groundwater input? Because it's that overall lake level that impacts the salinity. It impacts how much dust we're going to be exposed to when the wind blows off of the lake bed. And it also affects how much downwind rain and snow there's going to be, because Great Salt Lake is such an important source of water for the valley and for the mountains.
So my understanding is, you correct me on this, Great Salt Lake right now, after two incredibly wet years and after action from the legislature, and we're back to 2021 levels.
That's right. Well, and we don't need to belabor the Matthew LaPlante study, but you know, he said on Undisciplined that it's almost impossible that the lake drops below 2022 levels in the next numerous decades. Right, it's going to take so long, and yet here we are. We're at 2021 levels, just a year before the lake's all-time low. Thankfully, we're in a better situation today than we were then. We've got water in reservoirs that we could release as an emergency measure. Also, the salinity in the south arm of the lake is lower because we've allowed some of that water to flow over into the north arm. So we're in a better situation overall, but it's extremely alarming. And this is, again, getting back to this bank account analogy. If you want to be financially secure through time, you can't rely on a big gift from your parents, right? Or a windfall profit in a year. Those are really helpful, right? I am so grateful for the snow that fell in 2023 and 2024, right? Again, otherwise, the lake would have gone over that salinity threshold. We would have seen wholesale collapse of the lake ecosystem. So I'm so grateful for that. But we need to recognize that the only stable solution for this is if we we put more into the lake than we take out, right? If we live within our means. And the strike team report that came out yesterday is really clear that we need to consume a heck of a lot less water. So for example, they estimate that if we conserve around 750,000 acre feet of water a year, that only gives us a 45% chance of restoring the lake to a healthy level anytime in the future. And that already represents about a 25% decrease watershed-wide in the water that we're consuming. 25% decrease only gives us a coin flip chance at restoring the lake. This is why we're advocating, especially thinking about the Olympics, especially thinking about the 12 million birds that come through the Great Salt Lake. We need more water conservation than that. We're advocating for at least 1 million acre feet per year getting to Great Salt Lake. And there have been multiple programs put in place, and I really want to thank and recognize the legislature for what they have done. You know, they have in many ways, I attended a legal conference on water in California last year, and it was really interesting to see many of those legal experts said what's going on in Utah is what needs to be going on throughout the West as far as updating water laws, incentivizing conservation. So legislators have made huge steps forward, but there still are light years to go. If we look today at how much water has been conserved and delivered to Great Salt Lake because of all of those programs, it's not yet detectable. We haven't made a measurable increase in the overall amount of flow to Great Salt Lake. That doesn't mean that all of the programs are garbage and we shouldn't support them. No, we need to fund these projects, right? We need to make sure that there's enough money to acquire water rights, to either lease or purchase water from water rights holders and get it to Great Salt Lake to encourage farmers to adopt new practices and new crops that consume less water. There's a lot of opportunity there, but we're working under an extremely constrained timeline, right? The clock is literally ticking, and so we've got to move faster.
Let's see. I just found it. That's good. It was Speaker Schultz. He said recently that he has decided to put a pause on water bills during the upcoming session. He says he wants to evaluate all of the policies they put into effect and the $1 billion in funding to see what's working and what's not. I wonder what you think about that, about a pause.
Yeah, I really respect and appreciate Speaker Schultz and the work that he does. I'm really worried about going in that direction. There's nobody in the management of Great Salt Lake, no researchers that I've talked to, who believe that we've done enough. And this is really clear in the strike team report as well. Now, the strike team is funded by the legislature. They don't make policy recommendations. You know, they're really clear. But they do say, you know, it's going to require substantial new action, additional action. So even if all of the programs, so the major programs implemented by the state so far are an agriculture optimization program that helps farmers transition to more water-efficient distribution, the Watershed Enhancement Trust, really important group that's acquiring water rights for Great Salt Lake, the secondary water metering that's helping urban areas use less water, and then a water banking pilot that would give more flexibility to farmers and other water users, if they are conserving water, to potentially sell that, right, and have a monetary reward. We need to fund all of those programs. We also need to be thinking about additional options. So putting a pause right at the moment, I should just say, there's a real paradox with Great Salt Lake. The only years that we can make a big difference are wet years, where there's actually water that could be directed to the lake, that we could leave it in the rivers and have it get to the lake. And so we've got to have the long-term perspective as a community where we say, all right, yeah, the mountains are snowy, the reservoirs are full. This is actually the year that we need to conserve most. I'm going to install a smart controller to reduce the my sprinklers for my lawn, right? Lawn is a really big part of this picture, right? 150,000 acre feet of lawn, of turf grass in the watershed, consumes a heck of a lot of water. We should absolutely be watering our lawns less, and we should be long-term reducing the area of lawn. So we got to keep our foot on the accelerator.
I'll go back to the psychology here because, let me just ask it this way. It sounds like what you're saying is conservation is the biggest piece here. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. A lot of people's minds go to water augmentation. So if there's not enough water, let's see if we can find some more, right? That's super intuitive. But we found around the world that those water augmentation proposals are extremely costly, and they usually are unsuccessful. I was at a conference a couple of months ago in Turkey where a delegation from Iran presented what they tried to do to save Lake Urmia. Lake Urmia is very similar to Great Salt Lake, its size, its watershed, agricultural water use there. And they tried to use an engineering approach, right? Pipelines, canals, they even dug a new river across the desert, a channel for a new river, and ultimately they failed. Lake Urmia was destroyed. And most years now it's completely dry. That was because they were focusing on increasing the water supply. Now, the way that you can balance your water budget more effectively, as far as cost and resilience, is by reducing how much water you're using. And that's what we need to be focused on. The last year, the legislature created a new position of somebody who's in charge. It's Joel Ferry in the Department of Natural Resources, who's in charge of trying to find in the adjacent states, does anybody want to sell us water? Does anybody want to allow us to build canals and pipelines to bring more water in? Maybe they'll find something. But if you talk to anybody from Idaho or Colorado or Arizona or Nevada, they're not exactly flush in water. right? This is a regional problem. We're all living outside of our means. And so the only solution that's fast enough and that can get enough water is us wasting less.
What would you say, and I'm guessing most people aren't here, but I think some people are, someone who says, you know, it's me versus the lake. I come first.
Yeah.
I need my water for my business, for myself, whatever it is. The lake's downstream somewhere. What would you say to them?
You know, if you were to read op-eds about Great Salt Lake, I think that's the picture you'd get. Right, you've got one op-ed from somebody from an urban area or a suburban area who says it's all alfalfa, right? Why are we even worrying about lawns? We just should focus on alfalfa, right? It's all the farmer's fault. And then you've got an op-ed that responds and says it's a farmer saying, why should I reduce the acreage of my alfalfa, which is at least feeding cows and sheep, when you're wasting water on turf grass that you're not even using, right? I'm not going to reduce the acreage of crops until there's not a blade of Kentucky bluegrass in the watershed. And it's really counterproductive, right? It's true. Most of the water is being used by farmers, but they're putting it to good use. Less water is being used by cities, but much of it's being wasted just on decorative vegetation, right? We could have beautiful local vegetation that would be every bit as nice as our grass if we just got to work. So I think that we've got to stop pointing fingers and we've got to start taking action. And the state, the legislature should put more money into turf removal programs. It's interesting. There's a team, there's a Great Salt Lake project at the University of Utah that's done an analysis, and they find that the majority, if I'm remembering right, it's 2/3 of cities in the watershed don't have any water conservation policy on the books. And so this is something that each of us could do. Call up your city council and say, hey, what are we doing to conserve water? I don't want to be paying more on my bills. There's an awesome success story from the city of Sandy, where they invested in water conservation. And because of that, they didn't have to buy more water from the Central Utah Project. It saved the city $40 million. I mean, these are real impacts, and it's not us versus the lake. If we learn to live within our means, that's going to increase our food security. It's going to increase, decrease the amount of money that we have to spend to have beautiful outdoor landscapes. It's going to put us in a place that is much more resilient than we are today. And again, I just encourage everybody, think about that family member or friend who's always struggled with finances, not because they're not bringing in enough, but because they're having a hard time controlling their spending, right? That doesn't lead to a great place through the long term. If they increase their budget, if they increase how much they're bringing in, they always can increase how much they spend. So we want to be in the opposite situation. As the state continues to grow, that we are doing that in a water-wise way. We've actually been largely successful at that, right? Over the last 40 years, water consumption has not increased. The issue is that we were already in the red. We were spending more than we were bringing in. So even if that amount stays the same, we're going to end up in a bad place. We've got to decrease overall water consumption.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Ben Abbott. He's BYU Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability. And the Great Salt Lake Strike Team is out with a new report. Ben Abbott's team, I think, will be coming out with a report soon as well for 2025. We're talking about the future of the Great Salt Lake. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're looking to the future of the Great Salt Lake with Ben Abbott, BYU Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability. So Ben, your report, when is that coming out?
Hopefully by the end of the month, but it might be a little bit after that.
Yeah. All right.
Updated report on the status of the lake and the status of conservation programs so far.
Yeah. I think no one is advocating for this or even wanting this, but I wonder if you could paint us a picture, world without the lake. It's a shallow lake, and you know, if we fail, I look at those pictures of the RLC and it just hurts my heart. And I think everybody would hate that outcome. But what does that look like if that happened?
You know, we don't need an advanced numerical model to understand what would happen if Great Salt Lake went away, because this is a story that's played out, unfortunately, over and over again around the world. And when these lakes decline, it triggers a long-term and so far irreversible series of events that degrade the health of the people that live around the lake, that harm the economic prosperity, that cause breakdown in the ecological systems that provide the food, water, and air that we need, and ultimately a decline in human civilization around those areas. We've seen this on every continent except for Antarctica at this point, right? One example just from next door in California is Owens Lake. So this was a lake that's much smaller than Great Salt Lake. The tributaries were diverted to bring water for agriculture in the Los Angeles area, and the lake began to decline. The local community basically had to evacuate as these dust storms coming from the exposed lake bed became so severe that they couldn't grow crops, that they couldn't even stay there because of health issues. And Owens Lake became the largest source of particulate matter pollution in the whole country. And again, this is a lake that's 15 to 20 times smaller than Great Salt Lake. Here we've got a lake that's much bigger, that's nestled up against the largest urban area in the region, right along the Wasatch Front. And so we would absolutely be looking at a world with dirtier air, a world without as much rain and snow. We now know from estimates from Utah State that half of the rain and snow that falls along the Wasatch Front actually comes from evaporation from Great Salt Lake. So we're talking about a shift in the ecosystem type from this montane, verdant ecosystem that we all enjoy now to think about what the west side of Great Salt Lake looks like, the salt flats and the west desert, right? We'd be looking much more at that type of ecosystem. And this is a real threat, and this sounds dramatic, right? But it's a real threat to our way of life in this region. I think about, again, the history of my church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We've had to move our headquarters multiple times because of religious persecution and political issues. We don't want to have to do it again because of mismanagement of the largest lake, saline lake in the Western Hemisphere. Right. If we're interested in long-term flourishing for people, if we're interested in the future of agriculture in the watershed, we've got to bring our water use down. We've got to be in a sustainable range. And the last point that I'll bring up is there are over 400 bird species that depend on Great Salt Lake. Those birds travel to every state in the U.S. and every country in the Western Hemisphere. So if we lose the lake, we're not just talking about a local story. The ripples would go out throughout the whole Western Hemisphere. And I think that the world is watching us, right? People are interested. When there's a story about Great Salt Lake, it's often picked up by The Guardian, by the New York Times, right? So this is our moment where we can show that we're different, that we are the first community that can come together and save their lake, rather than follow the sad story of the Aral Sea or of Lop Nur or of Lake Popo, right? We're going, I personally believe that we can do this and that we will do this, but it's gonna take a lot of work, it's gonna take buy-in, and it is alarming to me. In 2022, Great Salt Lake was the number one or number two issue of public concern for Utahns based on representative polling. Last year, it was in slot 16, mm-hmm. right? Way down on the list. And so I think that this is something that each of us should be talking with our neighbors about, talking with our families and friends. Please, there are so many wonderful groups that are advocating for Great Salt Lake in a constructive way. Friends of Great Salt Lake, Grow the Flow. On the not this Saturday, but the following Saturday, there'll be a rally at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. It's a rally, not a protest. Right. It isn't. Mm-hmm. We're not going up there to say, we hate our state leaders. We're going up there to thank our state leaders for what they've done and to ask to work together to take the next steps. So that's 2 p.m., not this Saturday, but the next Saturday. You can find the info at Save Our Great Salt Lake. So the stakes are high, but I think that we're going to come together. But the odds are against us. You know, we need to be clear-eyed about that. Mm-hmm.
Well, we are heading into a legislative session, and so I want to ask you, you've outlined several things you feel the legislature should do. Maybe here toward the end of the program, give me your top three or something. What can the legislature, what should they do that have the most impact?
2 years ago, the legislature created the Office of the Great Salt Lake Commissioner. And I was way too cynical about that, Tom. In fact, I made a comment at the time that I thought that it was mainly symbolic. It wasn't going to change anything. It was a way of looking like they were making a change without actually doing anything. I've been proven wrong. Having Brian Steed is the name of the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, having Brian Steed in that position has really created kind of a quarterback, right? One person who's in charge, who's calling the plays, who's responsible for the lake. And that's really centralized in a constructive way our response. And so I think the most impactful thing that could be done is for the legislature to fully fund the Great Salt Lake Commissioner's office. And in the governor's budget, I think that there's $15 million allocated for that. That would be fabulous. That should be an ongoing appropriation. I think that $15 million is about how much it takes to redo 1 mile of I-15. So we spend $15 million on all kinds of things all the time. We need to be investing in a big way in Great Salt Lake. So we probably need $50 to $100 million based on some independent research that came out last week every year to acquire the water that we need to reverse the lake's decline. But $15 million every year would be a good start on that. We can really start accelerating. The second thing that we should do is begin working with the Utah Farm Bureau to educate and empower farmers to know about the programs that exist and make sure that those programs are fully funded. Right now, there are funds available, but many farmers are suspicious. Again, that lack of trust. They're worried, if I participate in the program, conserve water, and let it flow in the river, are my water rights going to be taken away next year or 10 years from now? The answer is absolutely not. They're now protected thanks to work that the legislature did. You can conserve water, and it's still considered a beneficial use. But those farmers need support. And so this is partly education, it's partly outreach, and then it's partly, honestly, better funding these programs that are helping farmers switch to other crops, right? Wheat consumes about half as much water as alfalfa does, but farmers can't get their wheat to market right now. And so investing in that infrastructure, and we of course love to criticize the inland port, and sometimes with good reason, but there are infrastructure bottlenecks. And we could use some of that inland port money to reduce some of that agricultural bottleneck. And I think that that would actually be a huge win-win. And then finally, I think that we need a marketing strategy for Great Salt Lake. Right now, there isn't anybody who has an independent marketing campaign helping the people of Utah connect with, love, value, and ultimately protect Great Salt Lake. And I think that that would really bear fruit because the people of Utah are proud of where they live, right? We came here for a reason, and we have plenty of examples of how we can do things differently in the state. But we've got to know about those pertinent facts and come together. And so I think that that could really be a high impact.
Maybe just about a minute left here, Ben. What's one thing you and I can do, regular Joes and Jills? What's the one thing?
The biggest impact that most of us have on Great Salt Lake is our outdoor landscapes. And so I was talking with a business person in the sprinkler system who estimated that most of us put twice as much water on our lawns as we need. And there are smart controllers that are available, and actually there's a state program that'll help offset the cost. That smart controller connects to your Wi-Fi, and it turns off the sprinklers when it rains. If it's super windy, it won't turn on the sprinklers. It'll give your lawn the water that it needs rather than just this automatic amount. And that could make a huge difference if everybody who has lawn starts with a smart controller and then makes a plan to reduce that lawn through time.
We're good. We're at the end of the program. This conversation will continue, I'm sure. We've been talking with Ben Abbott, BYU Associate Professor of Environmental Science and Sustainability. His team's report will be coming out a little bit later. Again, that rally is on the 25th, 2 p.m., you said?
That's right.
At the Capitol. Ben Abbott, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.